Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events this afternoon. And really excited to have Flynn Berry here. Her first official bookstore event on publication day. She's going to be talking about her new book, Northern Spy. And Flynn was nice enough to sign a bunch of copies for us, and I still have some right here at the store. And during the course of the discussion, I'll put in the comments field a little link to our store if you'd like to purchase a copy. And then our good friend, Adrian McKinty, has come in to kind of guest host this this program tonight. And this is, of course, a copy of his latest book, The Chain. But just for fun, Adrian, I brought this scarcity
oh, wow.
my collection. This is Adrian's first book. From way back in 1997.
Previous century.
Yes. And so Barbara's joining from her home office there. And welcome, everybody. It's great to have you all here.
So thank you, Patrick, for kicking us off, Flynn. A glass raised to you. Adrian has one, too. It's wonderful to join you on publication day. We were so excited when you came to see us with your second book in 2018, A Double Life, which was, if not, well, we could say perhaps loosely inspired by Lord Lucan, whose mysterious fate we are never going to know. But Flynn won the Edgar for Best First American Novel for Under the Harrow in 2017. And her new book that Patrick just held up is a new Reese Sunshine Book Club pick, which is really exciting. So congratulations. My question to you, Flynn, would be, why is the nice American girl from Los Angeles spending her time writing two British and now an Irish mystery?
Yeah, so I, most of my family is from Ireland. I haven't gone down the kind of rabbit hole of DNA and ancestry, but we are mostly Irish, and I feel like I was born in the wrong country. The first time I went to Ireland, I landed and it felt like that scene in Peter Pan when their shadows stitch back to the bottom of their feet. It just felt right, and I feel so at home there. And I think it's partly because all of my favorite writers growing up were British and Irish, and so it's this landscape that's partly fictional in my mind and partly real. And that I just find such intense pleasure spending time in. And I would like to go back permanently, but my family's all in the US.
Well, Adrian, who is the spouse of deep knowledge of Los Angeles, is going to instead show us his deep knowledge of Belfast, which is after all his home city. I am going to absent myself for a while because there's too many people on screen, and Patrick, who is Irish and far more knowledgeable than I about the territory you're going to cover, is going to lead this discussion, but I'm going to lurk and I can come back. So Adrian, over to you, my dear.
Hey, thank you, Barbara, and congratulations, Flynn, on your publication day. And I really enjoyed Northern Spy. And I, you know, when you said that you went to Ireland, I mean, everybody always goes to the Republic of Ireland, but very few American tourists ever venture north of the border. What sucked you up into the province of Ulster? Was it just curiosity? Did you have family there? Or what was the motivation for that?
I think it started with a book I read years ago by Deirdre Madden called One by One in the Darkness, which is a novel about three sisters whose father is murdered in a paramilitary attack during the Troubles. And it's one of my favorite books of all time. And the way she describes the landscape and the kind of beauty of ordinary life coexisting with the conflict just really struck me and got under my skin. And so it was a place I very much wanted to visit. I spent time in the Republic of Ireland as well, but I feel like my heart really was captured by Belfast and by the town of Grey Abbey, where Tessa lives in the book.
Sure,
and, yeah, and by the North Coast.
Tell us a little bit about Tess. Tell us a little, set up the book for us and tell us a little bit about Tess.
Right, so the novel is a psychological thriller about two sisters, Tessa and Marion, and their entanglement with the new IRA in Belfast. Tessa is a producer at the BBC. She produces a political radio show at the BBC in Belfast, and she's the mother of a young boy. She's the mother of a six-month-old baby. And Marion, her sister, is a paramedic who we find pretty early on in the book has some shadowy involvement with the IRA, and Tessa's trying to understand what it is.
And this is kind of set in the near future, like the tomorrow or like a month from now, that kind of vibe, rather than historical Troubles novels.
Yeah, I started off writing it set in the Troubles, but it felt, the more I was writing it, the more it felt contemporary. I think particularly as an American, I grew up actually in New York State, and I remember 9/11 when I was 15. I remember all the terrorism attacks and the huge responses to terrorism that our politics has been shaped by ever since. And so it felt really contemporary to be writing about this kind of life lived against the backdrop of these changing threat levels. It didn't feel like it was historical. And I was also inspired by an article I had read years ago, not that long ago, that said that the new IRA was using Brexit as a recruiting tool, and that they're actively recruiting new members and planning attacks, and that any infrastructure on the island of Ireland would be a legitimate target for an attack. And so it seemed like there's still so much tension under the surface.
It's really funny. It just feels so, you obviously wrote this like in the last year or two, but it feels so contemporary. I don't know if you caught the news from yesterday and today. The town I grew up in, Carrickfergus, was engulfed in riots last night and the night before and the night before, all on the surface Brexit-related rioting. So there's police Land Rovers, there's the helicopters up again. And it's funny, your book is peeking into the future. We all kind of would hope that this was the future that may never come, or a future maybe a couple of years from now. But you're really peeking into today. And tomorrow, all these tensions that are beneath the surface. So, how long did you spend in Northern Ireland? It must have been a few weeks, because you really have totally captured the cadence of life there and the way people speak and just the whole vibe of the place. Northern Ireland, as you know, it's drenched with atmosphere. And you really, when you're walking in Tessa's footsteps, you're really walking in that atmosphere.
I'm so glad you said that. I actually was terrified to write this book. I wanted to write it about 5 years ago and couldn't get started. And partly it was because I know how hard a Belfast accent is for actors. I know that actors get destroyed for their attempts at it. And I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to capture it in writing. And when I visited the first time years ago and was eavesdropping, there's just that rapid fire conversation. It's so witty, it's so sardonic. And I was thinking that there was no way I'd be able to get enough research done to make it work. So I'm glad that seems to have been pulled off. So I spent a few weeks there, and I also just did a huge amount of research before and after. One thing I did was watch every single archived episode of The Blame Game, which is a BBC comedy panel series where they make fun of current events and politics. And that helped a lot, because it was sort of not just the news headlines, but how people actually respond to them and how they make fun of them.
And you were down near Strangford, which people don't realize, it's actually gorgeous. It's actually the Grey Abbey, that whole east side of Strangford Lough. I mean, it's just stunning there. It's a lovely part of the world.
Yeah, I had Tessa living in a different village. And then while I was there, I saw, I think it was a bus sign with the name Grey Abbey, and thought it was such a beautiful name, and went and visited. And it was so gorgeous that I changed her whole home to it, because it just felt completely idyllic and yet so close to Belfast. So you can imagine how if things were kicking off again, you would feel that strange contrast between somewhere so peaceful and so idyllic looking being part of a complex zone still.
That's what people, I don't think, realize. I mean, Northern Ireland has such, the lightness and the dark are so next to one another, just in terms of like, extraordinary beauty, extraordinary humor, extraordinary friendship, and the kindness, but also real horrible darkness, like the most evil people walking the earth, and scenes of incredible ugliness, and the juxtaposition, it's really quite extraordinary. And when you make that journey from Strangford Lough, which is idyllic, I mean, it's this just pastoralist ideal, and then go into Belfast, especially through East Belfast and places like that, you go through some politely would say housing estates, and unpolitely you could say slums, really, like, you know, real working class housing. So I love the way Tess's journeys were a journey from the light into the dark and then back into the light again.
Thank you. And I imagine a lot of people have already read this, but Adrian's book series, The Sean Duffy Mysteries, he has the opening of The Cold, Cold Ground is this great scene where the police are up on a hill watching a riot, and they describe the beauty of the riot and how gorgeous it looks from afar. And there's the rain pouring down, and it looks like a ballet. And I think that is exactly right. Like, if from a distance, it looks so stunning and sort of otherworldly. But then up close.
Tell me about these two sisters. Tell me about Tessa, a little bit more about Tessa, a little bit more about Marion.
Yeah,
was it based on family? Was it based on people you know, or was it just made up?
So my mom is one of six children and four sisters, and it was definitely based on their dynamic and the kind of really intense love and way they can drive each other completely nuts at the same time. I wanted to capture that. And I think it's also really interesting to write about sisters because you have the same start, you have the same family, the same upbringing, and then you can sort of see what your avatar would be doing, like the life that you're not leading.
Absolutely.
And it was particularly interesting in this scenario with such heightened stakes. When I was over there researching, I heard about two sisters, and one of them left Northern Ireland and went away to university, and the other one joined the IRA. And so while one was studying in a university library, the other was lying in a ditch performing surveillance on a police station. Mm-hmm. And how is it possible that two women with the same upbringing could have such different lives? And so that seemed really fun to work with.
But that was also fascinating. That's what made it fascinating. You're absolutely right. People in Europe and in real life with the same DNA, the same geography, the same background, and yet they make completely different life choices. But what I really liked about the two sisters is that one of them isn't the black sheep. I mean, it's not as easy as that. They're both complicated people. You know, there's not one as the good girl. They're both kind of the good girl, but they go off and they make very different moral choices.
Yeah, and I think that's also really interesting. I think I get really frustrated with Irish Americans who romanticize the IRA. I think it's so prevalent here. And it's because we've never had any reason to fear them, right? Like, it was never our relatives who could be in trouble. So when you read about the troubles and all these Irish Americans sending huge donations to buy arms or explosives, it's kind of maddening. But I think at the same time, the IRA is interesting because their goal is so morally sort of understandable. Like the idea of ending colonialism, uniting the island of Ireland, I think most people can get behind that at some level. A lot of people. So it's interesting where you have such shadowy morality.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact that you waded into these waters and you decided not to make it easy. I mean, it's quite complicated on all sides. And I like the fact that you brought in, I love doing this too, because it's also true. Tell me about MI5 and how they get involved. There's no spoilers here. We won't talk about anything past the first third, but I think that can take us up to about the first third. Talk about how morally complex that situation is with the police, the security services, and that kind of situation.
Yeah, I feel like I could have kept researching this book for the rest of my life, and I could have written 15 novels about the MI5 activities in Northern Ireland. It's just pretty nuts. It's there's still hundreds of agents in Northern Ireland from MI5. There's still a huge base there. And one woman described it to me as sort of a training ground, like that the agents would go to Northern Ireland to learn how to fight terrorism internationally. And during the Troubles, MI5 was so sort of threaded through all of the conflict as informers on both sides. And one statistic I read was that one in every four IRA members was working for the British state at one point. And so obviously that's led to really complicated situations where like you have an informer who's a British agent who's authorized to commit murder or authorized to be part of a terrorist activity, because the sort of long game is gonna pay off in the end.
Yeah. So I think that statistic is completely true. I think about one in four of the IRA was actually working for the British, and I think about one in three of the loyalist terrorists were actually working for the British as either a fully formed paid agent or just a casual informer, which is extraordinary because it's like you control all the pieces of the game and you're playing against yourself. It reminded me of, I remember when I watched The Departed, that Jack Nicholson, Martin Scorsese movie, when they're all trying to nail Jack Nicholson. And they're wondering why he keeps getting away with it. You know, the Boston police are trying to nail him, and the state troopers are trying to nail him, and he keeps getting away with it. And the reason he keeps getting away with it because he's informing for the FBI, so he's actually an FBI agent, and that's kind of the way Northern Ireland was as well. You know, how do these guys keep getting away with it? And there's a reason for that, because there's wheels within wheels within wheels. It's an incredibly complicated situation. Not saying that your book isn't complicated or hard to follow or anything like that. I think you took the complex situation, and with the real clarity, you gave us these characters' moral choices and the decisions they had to make. And also, I think you showed us that with every moral decision, it's a slippery slope. You just make one little step, and then it leads to another little step and another little step. And before you really know what you're doing, you've got yourself in over your head. Tell me a little bit about I'm really fascinated by this because my sister worked at the BBC in Belfast. Tell me about that milieu. What attracted you to that?
So I started off just listening to political radio shows as research. And then I was listening to the politics podcast hosted by Mark Davenport, and it just started to seem like the perfect way to get a lot of political backstory into the novel in a kind of easy and elegant way, instead of, you know, loading in a chapter. So Tessa works at the BBC. She's a producer of a political radio show. And when I was there, I actually got to sort of pretend I worked at the BBC. I shadowed a producer, and I got to sit in on live recordings and watch the sort of chat with politicians before the interview started. And it was really strange, because at some point I was making tea in the staff kitchen. I had a badge around my neck, and I just felt like I'd become my character in this very sort of surreal way. And it was lovely. It was just the best way to get some level of authenticity to being a producer without having had that job. And then I also had a producer who I had shadowed read the whole manuscript and give me notes on what seemed inaccurate. So if someone made a comment and she said, no, they wouldn't say that. And then her teenage daughter sent me a list of Belfast slang, which I could.
Right. I could tell you'd actually been in there, because I knew you went through that security guy, and I recognized the badges from around the neck. You know, those big paper plastic badges that they make everybody wear. But it just seems I thought it was really interesting, because you're writing this book as from an external POV, and you're writing this tough story, but there seems to be real love for like the people and the culture and the city in there. It's like you really sort of, you can tell that Belfast really got under your skin.
I think it was especially the women that I interviewed. I interviewed a security journalist, the producer, a woman named Maria Cahill, who's a journalist and politician. And each of those interviews, I arrived thinking it would be, you know, like a 20-minute coffee. And we ended up talking for hours. And I completely fell in love with all of them and really wanted to capture the women of Belfast in particular, and how the women I met were just tough as nails. They weren't bullied by anyone. They weren't scared of anyone. They were paramilitants and leaders of organized crime and laughing about the threats that they got. Yeah. And it's just a really fun type of character to write, I think.
I think that's so important that you said that, because when you get troubles narratives or narratives about Northern Ireland, so often we get this macho male perspective. And every time you see an American movie, it's always this conflicted, usually a handsome actor like Brad Pitt or Mickey Rourke in his super handsome phase, you know, is there, and they're wrestling with, you know, these moral dilemmas or whatever. And the women are always in the background, side characters, you know, tutting them over their washing, whatever. But here, the women are front and center of the story. And I think that's, not before time, but it's also very, very necessary that this story is told from that point of view. it drew, I don't know how you felt about Anna Burns's book, Milkman, but it drove me crazy when I read the New York Times review, which was a bad review of this book that won the Booker Prize. But the New York Times, it was so condescending and arrogant and said, oh, we've heard this story before. We can't understand what these people are talking about. And I was thinking, you've never heard this story before. You've never once ever heard the women of Belfast ever tell their story, because I've seen all the movies that you've seen, and they're always excluded. And so I think it's absolutely crucial that this is a woman's story from a woman's perspective, and these two sisters. And I love the fact that it's also a story about motherhood. And tell us a little bit about Tessa's relationship with her child and her relationship with her own mother.
So I also just wanted to mention, I had heard an interview you gave years ago where you said that IRA men get great casting and the cops get terrible casting.
It's true.
There's such a strange, you know, you have like Cillian Murphy as an IRA man, right? He's gorgeous.
It's always the most handsome actors.
Yeah, we do romanticize them. And I love Milkman. I think that perspective of the girl just trying to walk along the street, reading a book and getting harassed by a paramilitant is really important. And same with Dairy Girls. I think Dairy Girls did such a good job of showing it in a realistic way of what it would be like to be a teenager. And with the mother, I think that just came really naturally because I had a baby while I was writing the book.
But I was wondering, how old was your, was it your first or second child?
My first kid. So I started the book in my first trimester with him. And then—
Oh, you were pregnant?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was interesting because I think I felt so worried a lot during my pregnancy, and the book was kind of a tow rope, so I could put all my sort of fears and my into it, which helped a lot. And then so she was pregnant in the early drafts, and then once he was a baby, I changed it and reworked it so she has a 6-month-old baby, and I was sort of writing it in real time. So when my son Ronan was 6 months old, the baby in the book is 6 months old, and he grows to be about a year old. It felt like a very satisfying way to record this huge moment in my life. And I think also I get really frustrated with depictions of new motherhood often, because I think they're often really sentimental or they're really bleak. And there's not too much that I've found, and I just like grab everything I find that I think strikes the right balance of how it's the best and the worst in every single day. I want to capture that.
Although I love the fact that you captured the fact that she's exhausted a lot of the time, because that can add to the surreal nature of the situation. If you're going through a crisis and you're also sleep deprived, and so the world is kind of erupting around you and you haven't had a good night's sleep for like 3 or 4 days, I also think that that's really interesting. Maybe we should talk a little bit more about the actual story. So she discovers what about her sister?
So Tessa's at work and she sees security footage of her sister outside of a gas station pulling a ski mask over her head. Mm-hmm. And police are looking for her. They think that she's a member of the IRA, and Tessa's convinced that she isn't and that she's been coerced into doing something on their behalf. And so the book is her investigation into what's happened to her sister and where her sister is.
So there's three parallel investigations. There's her investigation, there's the police investigation, and then there's the MI5 also trying to figure out what exactly is happening, which is fantastic because you get three levels of knowledge. The police know one thing, she knows another thing, and MI5 knows the other thing. And then of course, Marion thinks she knows the full picture, but does she really know the full picture of what's happening? And people have to make these tough moral choices with insufficient information. Like, they don't know everything. And that's what's so interesting about the story, is you never will know. And so you have to leap based on the data that you have. I really love that. And what about Tessa's relationship with her own mother? So it's like the motherhood works two ways. There's the top down and there's the bottom up. So talk a little bit about that if you don't mind.
Yeah, so she wasn't really a character until after I had visited Belfast and I heard from the women I interviewed about their own mothers and their grandmothers and how they were just trying to sort of keep their families going during a war that they were living through, particularly in West Belfast, and how the women would, just be raising their children in this really extreme scenario. Maria Cahill told me about her mother once going outside to the front garden, and there are two British soldiers who had taken Maria's soccer ball. And she said, can you give my four-year-old her soccer ball back now, please? And just that kind of strange contrast between trying to keep things normal for your children and then living alongside soldiers and raids. I just was really interested in that. And also in the sort of class system and what happens to a woman like that who's working as a housekeeper for a wealthy family if her family suddenly seems to be under suspicion.
Yeah. I like, speaking of that, I remember one night, me and my little brother, we shared a bunk bed, and my big brother was on the top bunk, but my big brother had a sleepover. So me and my little brother were on the bottom bunk one night, and we heard this commotion in the street. And we pull back the curtains, and the entire street is full of seemingly all the British Army. And there's about three or four soldiers in our front garden. And, soldier to little boys, that's so fantastic. These soldiers with guns are in the front garden. And I remember I was very young, and I remember going down the stairs, and my mother was awake, and obviously, and I said to my mom, what's happening? And my mother said, nothing, go back to bed. And I remember, and I did go back to bed, but I remember thinking, well, if this is nothing, I really wonder what something would be. Like, what would constitute something? And that was the sort of level of normalcy that was happening, and it turned out they were arresting our neighbor two or three along, who turned out to be a mass murderer. had killed like three people he admitted to. Anyway,
you mind if I jump in just for a second?
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you both a question, which was I was in Belfast in 1999. Mm-hmm. Which was, I think, was that a year after the Good Friday?
It's year one.
Year one. And it's funny because when we started in Dublin, we spent 3 weeks. It was just a wonderful time. He kind of circumnavigated the island. And we went up to Inishowen, and which was stunning. And then down, Donegal, up through the north, and then down through Belfast. And I too was really taken with Belfast, that famous Catholic cemetery and the
Milltown
and the all the Bobby Sands murals and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that Flynn, I think, did really well in the book was describing the minutiae, of certain businesses, being, oh, that's a Catholic bakery, that's a Protestant. You hear about the Shankill Road and the Falls Road and, these very almost a segregated city in some respects with a lot of uneasy mingling. Has that changed a lot in the last 20 years since the agreement? Or is it from what I'm hearing, it's kind of going back and coming apart again?
Flynn, as an outsider, I think will have a more interesting POV than I would, but I always, there's a book I know, it's called The City and the City by China Mieville. Did you guys ever read that?
Brilliant, book? Brilliant book.
It's a wonderful novel, and it's about two cultures coexisting in one city, and they don't even look at one another. And I almost feel that's like the best novel ever written about Belfast, because it's set in Eastern Europe, but it just feels like Belfast to me. Whereas these two people, and you're always feeling one another out. Like, I've never had a conversation, it's to my eternal embarrassment and shame, that I've never had a conversation with anybody from Northern Ireland where within 5 minutes I don't figure out what religion they are. And I'm trying not to. I don't ask them. I don't ask them what primary school they went to, which is obviously a big clue. I try so hard not to, and yet I always figure it out. Because of these social clues or things that I have asked in an odd way, And so I find that quite depressing.
But it's almost like What are some of the subtler tells?
Oh, like surnames, you know, again, what primary school you went to, what part of town, like if you're from, like the characters in this book, Andersonstown, like I 100% know where they were from. Again, what opticians or bakery or bookmaker or pubs they would go to, or even how they would say, pronounce the letter H. And Catholics generally would say H, Protestants would say H. So there's all these little subtle tells, and you can't help it, but within 5 minutes, you know where everyone is from, which is, you know, it's like you're cursed to have this superpower that you don't want. Flynn, what did you think?
I thought the letter H was one of the funnier things I've ever heard in my life, that you have people who are so indistinguishable, aside from how they pronounce one particular letter. It's just kind of hilarious. Like, you couldn't make that up. And it is, it's interesting because I think there's so much hope and there's so much energy in Belfast. And I think it is at peace. And then at the same time, you still have peace walls in the city that are massive steel fences dividing communities. And like you said, Adrian, people know who someone is based on that. And schools are segregated, which is really insane to me, that schools haven't been integrated since the Good Friday Agreement.
Crazy. Yeah, middle-class schools, there's these integrated schooling movement for middle-class kids, but working-class schools, 100% not integrated at all. So if I was to say, which I would never do, which primary school did you go to? I would know immediately if someone was a Protestant or a Catholic. But I do love the fact Belfast people, yeah, I think what you're talking about is what Freud called the narcissism of the small differences, because these are two cultures. They're identical. You know, they dress the same. They look the same. They talk exactly the same way. And they have the same, they support the same football teams. And yet this one little thing of religion, nobody even really goes to church anymore. Like, people don't even, it's such an absurdity. And yet it's so important. It literally could be a matter of life and death. You know, it's so interesting to me. But again, I really think that you captured that in an incredible way. And I love the fact that I was listening to the thing about the narcissism, people from Belfast are always fascinated by non-Belfasters feel about their city. I was listening to the Marc Maron podcast a couple of weeks ago, and Nicole Kidman was on, and she was making a film in Belfast. And she was sitting talking for the first 10 minutes about how much she loved Belfast. And I couldn't help it. I found myself tweeting it. Oh my God, validation. Nicole Kidman thinks Belfast is okay. So it's very funny that way, you know, that you get it. So where did you, if you don't mind me asking, so Flynn, you grew up in upstate New York. Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Irvington, which is on the Hudson River.
I have no idea where that is. North of Hyde Park?
South of Hyde Park.
South of Hyde Park. Oh, so you're fairly near the city?
Yeah. Technically, you could say Westchester, but I choose not to.
Okay. Just for political reasons, you don't want to say Westchester.
Sleepy Hollow. Just like Sleepy Hollow, right?
I totally understand. So, you actually were in Westchester County? Is that correct?
Yeah. The town's
name. You're a New Yorker. You're a New York City person, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really liked writing Tessa's Home in Grabby because I feel like where I grew up is a little similar in that you have this big body of water and it looks very calm and it's such a small town and you know everyone, but you're close to this, you know, massive city.
And did you always want to be a writer? Is that what you wanted to do with your life as a kid?
I did, yeah. I have always loved reading. I think I'm a reader first and a writer second. I would keep reading over almost anything. My mother-in-law asked if I would rather live with my husband or keep reading, if I had to give up one or the other. Could we live near each other and visit? Like, is that an option? Yeah. So I think the writing came from that. I think the wanting to tell stories came from having read so much when I was younger.
Is that what you studied in college? Where did you go to? Where did you go to school?
Brown, and I studied creative writing there.
You went to Brown. Did you know Brian Evanson?
I did. He was one of my professors.
That is so ridiculous. Brian is one of my best friends. That's crazy. What was he like as a teacher? Was he a big goofball?
He's the nicest man in the world. And I remember I read a story about a complete horror story that he had written about something happening to someone's eye that I won't spoil what happens. And thinking like, oh, all right.
Because he looks like a cuddly bear, but he writes about the darkest stuff imaginable.
Yeah, but he was a really encouraging and lovely teacher. And I dog sat for him, actually.
Right.
And I remember seeing, this is probably too much information that I shouldn't be sharing publicly, but while I was dog sitting, he had a schedule on his fridge, taped to his fridge, about when he had to write and the things he couldn't do while he was writing. So he couldn't, watch TV, he couldn't play a video game. He had to have a certain number of hours. And I was, 20. And I remember thinking, oh, this is how you actually do it. You have to actually set rules for yourself. It's not just, the muse. Yeah,
the video games. I remember telling him that I'd finished Call of Duty. And Brian told me, what are you talking about? It came out like 9 months ago. I finished it the second day. What have you been doing? I said, I had a few problems in Stalingrad. He says, oh my God, I did Stalingrad in 20 minutes. That's so funny that you studied with Brian. How do you write? What is your schedule? Is it morning person, afternoon? How do you do it?
I have two tiny children right now, so it's just a nightmare. It's just right. But in general, I write in the mornings. With my first kid, I would write in his naps. And now we have some childcare in the morning and I write then. I think it's usually best. I always write longhand and I try to create the most atmosphere that I can. So I listen to the same piano songs on repeat. I read something that you had said about living in Australia, but writing about Belfast and listening to like the sound of rain on a tin roof.
Yeah, I do.
I feel like I do similar things to try to get that atmosphere going.
What's the piano? What piano pieces do you listen to?
I like Max Richter and Olafur Arnalds and A Winged Victory for the Sullen. And they're kind of these like shadowy, atmospheric, sweeping piano songs.
I know so many writers that listen to Max Richter. He's ridiculously good to listen to if you want to write or if you want to sleep or if you want to sculpt or do anything. It's because of I think it works in your brain because of the repetition, but also the creativity within the so it's not boring, but it's not overly distracting. So that you can, it gets the juices flowing in a really interesting way. Whereas if it was like, I don't know, rock music or something else, so anything, you don't listen to anything but lyrics, do you? Mm-hmm. No, it's impossible. And I remember, Patrick will know this, History of Seven Killings. Who's that guy? Won the Booker a few years
ago. Marlon James.
I remember talking to him. And he's saying, oh yeah, he listens to whatever's on the radio, like top 40. Yeah, he just has a blaring. And he was teaching in college and he has a ground floor window. And he opens the window and pushes his desk up a window. And he says the students will walk past and say, hey, hi Marlon, how's it going? And he'll have conversations. So, and he leaves his door open as well. So it's like an invitation for anybody to come in at any time or anybody to contribute. And the radio's going and he processes all that in his computer. And then somehow, like, if I hear a conversation on the street, like, two streets away, that's it. I go, okay, that's it. I'm done for the day. It's all spoiled. I can't do anything. Whereas Marlon is like, bring it on. Bring it all in. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
What's your desk, Flynn? What is your desk like?
It's
clean. Is it tidy?
It's an IKEA table.
Okay, good. So is mine.
And it doesn't have anything on it. So I write on just plain printer paper with like a cheap ballpoint pen, which I think is good. Then you can try out a lot of different things and you don't feel like it has to stick.
That is so fascinating. So your desk is empty. You just have sheets of paper and a pen. So if you were transported back in time 400 years ago, you'd be fine.
I'd be so happy. I say that all the time. I really have a hard time with the internet.
You're in the 16th century, you would have no problems.
It would be glorious. Yeah, I could go walk around the field and then come back and write and it'd be miraculous.
Unlined paper too. You got to love that. Yeah. Barbara's back.
Because I thought, Patrick, you might want to see if there are some questions that you would like to
address,
or Flynn would like to address, rather.
There are some questions. Let's see. Robin asks, what most surprised you in doing your research for this book?
Good question.
There is just so much that I couldn't get into the book, and I wish I could have. A couple things that I squeezed some of this in, but I was really interested in how the new IRA is fundraising right now. And one of the ways I heard they're fundraising is they rent out bouncy castles for kids' birthday parties, and hot tubs. So you can have a truck come up to your house when you're having a party and with a portable hot tub in the back. Like, this is crazy. And that they were laundering money through nail salons and tanning beds. So that's why there are so many nail salons on the Falls Road. They're all to launder money. That was really interesting. And then a lot of just the BBC talk during meetings. I went to a couple of the news meetings where all these editors are talking about which stories they're going to work on that day. And it felt like just the best conversation I've ever eavesdropped on in my life. These people are just so smart and so funny. And I was transcribing everything they said, and some of that made it into the book verbatim. Like the scene, the news meeting scene is pretty much verbatim what I heard when I was there. But there is, you know, notebooks full of that I couldn't actually get in.
I noticed Mark gets a little acknowledgement at the end of the book, Mark Davenport. If people don't know, is quite a famous Northern Irish TV reporter.
Yeah, he was really generous, and he let me shadow him and just sort of showed me what he was doing throughout the day. It was so much more access than I was expecting, and it was really generous of him. It's very kind.
Here's a toughie. Did your opinion of the IRA change in the process of writing this book?
That's really interesting. I think I can see it from all angles. I think you read about why certain people were radicalized. You read about, there's a politician, Martina Anderson, who served time for explosive charges. And she talks about how when she was growing up in Derry, her house was kicked in by soldiers. It was searched constantly. Male family members and friends would just go missing. They would be interned without trial. And you can see how someone would feel like they had to take up arms if they felt that level of threat or being under siege to that degree. But then I also read a book called Lost Lives, which is a encyclopedia of every single victim from the Troubles. So paramilitants and civilians. It's children, it's people who had no involvement whatsoever in the conflict and were innocent bystanders. And you read that and you think that nothing's possibly worth doing this. No sort of political goal could be worth it.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question for you. You know, you mentioned some of the movies that have been made dealing with the issues. I guess a question for both of you, have you seen any films that you felt got it kind of right? Are they all Hollywood? I kind of like that film Cal. Did you ever see that?
Oh yeah.
On the Bernard McLaverty novel. I thought that was good.
I'm not done with that one either. I think there hasn't been a single good one. But Flynn, over to you.
I think it's really hard. I mean, so many of them are kind of cartoonish, like the Devil's Own with Brad Pitt as the IRA man. It just feels like no one's really gone into the subtlety of maybe the more modern era of the conflict. Like I think The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is looking at the original, you know, uprising, has more nuance to it. But it's hard. I think it's hard to do.
I have a question, which is, Adrian's already kind of addressed it, is that it's easy to think that this is a religious conflict, that we have, you know, Catholic Ireland and Protestant England, and that's where the problem is. But it seems to me that since religion, I mean, I was in Ireland 2 years ago, I've done several trips to Ireland. And as Adrian said, people don't really go to church anymore, except for those major events, you know, christening and wedding and a funeral. So religion doesn't seem to me to be that potent a force. So when you were there, did you feel like this was really a political thing? You know, I mean, it's like Ireland wants to be unified, but Britain doesn't want to, or the people in the British part, the Free State don't want to give up their British citizenship? Is that really what it's coming down to? And if that's true, Brexit, it seems to me, is just going to create all kinds of tremendous problems all over again.
Yeah, I think Brexit is really interesting because it shows how little people in London in power were thinking about Northern Ireland when it happened. Like, they sort of just thought it would all work out, and it just isn't working out. I'll be curious what Adrian has to say about that. I think what I heard a lot was how hard it would be to forgive a side that had done such atrocities. So you have this constant, what about? So someone would mention one atrocity and then the other side can mention another one. And I think there hasn't been this big sort of truth and reconciliation movement that you have in other post-conflict countries where everything's been addressed. So there's just a lot that's still under the surface where people...
I think that's true. South Africa famously had that Truth and Reconciliation Commission where everything was brought up, everybody confessed everything, and then they said, okay, it's all been talked about, now let's draw a line under it and move on. And that never happened in Belfast. They just said, okay, let's just forget about it, not talk about it. And that doesn't really work. You know, it has to be processed somehow. But what you're doing is helping the process of it by interrogating it and talking about these issues. I think this stuff helps. I think talking about it and looking at it and exploring it through fiction or poetry or film, I think that really, really helps. And especially exploring it in a nuanced way, and a non-schlocky way. I think that's really good.
I think telling us your women's stories is a very effective way to do it, because you've already talked about that. Mm-hmm. So often the actors and the points of view are male, you know, yeah, soldiers or whatever. But I think, you know, everyday life, Pat, who are we just talking to? A World War II discussion about, you know, no matter how terrible the battles and the bombs falling and all the rest of it, people had to get on with everyday life. They still have to do their laundry and, you know, cook food and, you know, mind their children and the rest of it, as all of this.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that Flynn captures really well is that, you know, it's funny, there would be an atrocity or something terrible would happen. And then the next day, everyone still has to get up and go to work. You know,
yeah, somebody has to make the tea and stir the oatmeal and, you know, get the kids. So Flynn, if this book has consumed you for so long, you know, I mean, aside from motherhood slowing you down from 2018 to 2021, and anyone who's ever had small children has been in a stupor of exhaustion. There is just no way around it. When you have little kids, I mean, you're so tired all the time. It's amazing that you can function. But what do you see yourself writing next? I mean, you know, you've done three books, none of which are connected to each other. What is it you think you'd like to look at now?
I think first, it's been really hard to let this one go. Even that point that you were saying about how there's an atrocity and then everyone goes about their business. One of the stories I heard was how you know, like a bomb would go off down the street and people would be in a bar and would just like hold their hands over their pint glasses so dust wouldn't fall into it, and then just keep drinking after, you know, the explosion had stopped. And that still feels like such good territory for fiction. Like, I'm so excited to read more books that come out about Northern Ireland, and we'll still be very interested in it and reading other works by other writers. For now, my new book is set in New England, but it's still early days, so I'm not talking about it yet, but it is in America. I feel like I had to finally sort of shift my gaze this way.
I have a quick kind of comment, really. I remember I was talking to Ian Rankin, I don't know, last year or something, and he was talking about Rory Gallagher, you know, or Gallagher, mm-hmm. as you say over in Ireland, you know, the Irish, famous Irish guitar player. And apparently he had a running gig I'm not sure if it's every New Year's, but in Belfast, you know, no matter what was going on. And he had a real reputation of joining, you know, kids together.
Yeah.
Are there other examples you can think of, Adrian or Flynn?
There are lots of cross-community schemes and things to bring people together. And it's funny, normalcy flourishes, like even in, you know, a gray cement slab, there's always a little green shoot coming up through the cracks in the pavement. And, you know, that happened even in the darkest days of the 80s. You would always see like these little splices of normalcy. And you know, Ian's a really good example, Rankin, because his wife's from Belfast. And he would talk, he's talked to me about how he would go over on the ferry in the 1980s. And it was always amazing to me to see tourists in Belfast in the 80s. Usually they were German, if truth be told. They were usually like German backpackers and they're wearing shorts in November with full backpacks. But, you know, there was this, I remember this poetry collection came out a few years ago called A Rage for Order. And there was always that. There was always this desire, you know, to give the kids a normal life, to take them on a holiday, you know, to get, you know, there was this rage for, you know, let's try and bring all this chaos into some sort of rubric of order. And I think there was always little fragments of that happening all the time in amongst the chaos.
There's a question here, just kind of following up a little bit on the MI5 stuff in the book. She says, how does one research the MI5? Just kind of a fair question.
So they have a public website that you can go on, and I actually filled out an application to join as an intelligence officer to see what they ask and what sort of questions they ask. And they have a really glamorous website that kind of targets working women. A few years ago, they actually started recruiting stay-at-home mothers. They started posting on Mumsnet, this forum for parents, to try to get women who had been out of work raising their families to come be agent handlers. So they're trying to make themselves seem like a kind of good modern workplace where you can have a good work-life balance. And so they're open in a lot of ways. But then the biggest way that I researched it was that you have a bunch of informers who have written memoirs. So they've talked about what it was like to be an informer and to work with an MI5 handler. And you can read that, which is a really interesting subgenre because they were publishing those books at like this huge personal risk to their own lives to come out as informers.
It's interesting. Stella Remington, who she headed MI6, isn't that right?
Yes.
No, she was MI5.
Was it MI5?
Yeah.
You know, she came here once, Barbara, and I think you were actually out of town at that time.
I was. Sorry I missed it.
Yeah, that had to be one of the most fascinating, because I got to interview her in front of a little group of people. And, you know, she was talking about, you know, what it was like to rise up through the ranks, you know, of a very male-dominated field.
Sure.
You know, and
she also wrote about the real terror that she faced was the terrorist within, not the external, you know, the obvious terrorist, but the homegrown internal one. And, you know, with all this plethora of World War II stories that have just inundated publishing in the last couple of years, you recognize that, you know, we think of Britain as standing so firmly against Germany and all, and yet there are an awful lot of people in Britain who are sympathetic to the Nazis, who actually helped the Nazis. And those are the kinds of people that Stella found in her books anyway, to be so terrifying. And that comes down to what Flynn's been talking about
nothing,
you know, which people, you can't tell which what's a true face.
One of the things Flynn talks about a little bit in this is the internal security units. And each terrorist organization in Northern Ireland would have its own internal security unit where they would have a unit that would look at every thing that had gone wrong and try and figure out if it had gone wrong because it's just an accident, or if it had gone wrong on purpose because someone's really working for MI5. And those were the most feared people in Northern Ireland, not the police, not the army, not MI5, not MI6, but in the IRA, what was called the Nutting Squad, where they would want to know if you were loyal or not. And
good name for a book, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were a terrifying bunch of people.
The Nutting Squad.
The nutting squad.
That's right. But, you know, in all of this, we've talked about politics, we've talked about a lot of things, but one thing we haven't talked about is what a really lovely stylist Flynn is. I have read all three of her books, and I am always mesmerized by her perfectly beautiful prose. You know, I know that you've, were you at Yaddo? Didn't you do some extra work? I think, I remember going to Yaddo, not as a, just a tourist and wandering around it and thinking what an amazing place that it would be, so peaceful. But, you know, I think you're quite young. You're only in your 30s, much younger. I have grandchildren your age, so it's really sort of unnerving. But nonetheless, I do think that you are a remarkably skilled and beautiful writer, regardless of what you're writing about. And at such a young age, that's really an amazing achievement. So
can I just add to that a little bit, Barbara? One of the things I love about what Flynn does in the book is that there's the, instead of going for the easy climax, she sometimes goes for the anticlimax. So there's a bit where early in the book, we think there's been a terrorist bombing, but it's not. It's a lorry, a truck has crashed into a building and disloads some pallets. And I thought to myself, aha, now a lesser writer would have had, it's been 30 pages. The reader hasn't had a huge climax here. There's been no explosion, no killing, nothing like that. And Flynn decided to eschew the easy option and go for the subtler, more sensible, more intriguing possibility. And I like that. I love that when writers take you in a zig in when you're expecting the zag.
Well, thank you. And I think I would happily write only about like trees or swimming or food for pages and pages and pages. And so I think this genre has been so much fun because you have that structure where you're working with some mystery and some frame, and then you get to just play. You get to put in all the things you love about writing about raising children or food or family, but it has this solid frame to hold it all together.
I really loved A Double Life. I mean, of course, I always thought the Lord Lucan thing was a fascinating subject, but I have to say that really was a remarkable book. We sold an enormous amount of it. In fact, we ran out of it, if you remember, all too quickly. But I do think that, you know, your three novels are certainly impressive, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to do next, although I'm sort of stunned to know you're actually coming to the United States. I thought you were going to remain the American writer who's never going to write about anything in the United States. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Flynn, if we have time for one more question, what are you reading now that's exciting you, that's intriguing you?
Oh, so that you asked. I'm reading, I read this. Oh, no, it's backwards on the camera. It's called Acts of Desperation by Megan Nolan. Mm-hmm. And compared a lot to Sally Rooney, because any young writer from Dublin will get compared to Sally Rooney. But she's a beautiful writer, and it's a book about a kind of very dark love story in contemporary Dublin. And it's been wonderful. And then I'm also reading Slow Horses by Mick Herron, which is about the the MI5 spies who are dismissed with dishonor from their job and are put in this kind of unit for misfits where they try to muddle along. So that's been really fun too.
Yeah,
Mick. He's a very interesting writer. And I've followed him from the very, very beginning. And I never thought that he would actually break out, but here he is. And I also attribute part of that to the fact that John le Carré has left us. And, you know, Mick has come along. There's kind of a segue, I think, a natural segue there, but such an interesting worldview. Flynn, this has been wonderful. Let me once again raise a glass to you on publication day. Thank you for joining us. And Adrian, as always, you're amazing. One of these days we'll have a book from you again, right?
Yes, I'll get my act together at some point. Congratulations, Flynn.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Adrian. A pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. I want to thank everybody who's watched it this evening. There will be a podcast of this available probably tomorrow. The video is going to live on our Facebook video page forever. So if you've enjoyed this, do recommend to your friends. You don't need to belong to Facebook in order to watch our videos. And Patrick might even put this on YouTube. So we try to maximize the platforms. Anyway, thank you all for joining us. Have a wonderful evening. Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.